Chapter 44. That man's ultimate happiness does not consist in the knowledge of separate substances as pretended by the aforesaid opinions. But it is impossible to allow that man's happiness consists in such a knowledge of separate substances as the above-mentioned opinions, for it is of no purpose to strive for an end by means which cannot secure that end. Since then man's ultimate end is happiness, to which his natural desire tends, it is impossible to assign man's happiness to that which he cannot obtain, else it would follow that man was made in vain, and that his natural desire is void, which is impossible. Now it is clear from what we have said that it is impossible for man to understand separate substances, as laid down by the above-mentioned opinions. Therefore man's happiness does not consist in such knowledge of separate substances. Again, in order that the active intellect be united to us as a form so that by it we may understand separate substances, it is required that the generation of the habitual intellect be complete, according to Alexander, or that all the principles of understanding be actualized in us, according to Averroes, both of which amount to the same. Because the habitual intellect is engendered in us, by the principles of understanding being actualized in us. Now all the species of sensible things are understood potentially. Wherefore, in order that the active intellect be joined to a man, it is necessary that he actually understand by his speculative intellect all the natures of sensible things, and all their powers, operations and movements. But it is impossible for a man to know all this through the principles of speculative sciences, whereby we are moved to the conjunction with the active intellect, as they say, for it is not possible to acquire knowledge of all these things, from those which come under the perception of our senses, whence the principles of speculative sciences are derived. Therefore it is impossible for any man to arrive at this conjunction in the way assigned by them, and consequently man's happiness cannot consist in such a union. Besides, granted that it be possible for man to be united to the active intellect in the manner suggested, it is clear that such a perfection is obtainable by very few, so much so that neither they nor anyone else, however much they be advanced and skilled in speculative sciences, have dared to boast of having obtained this perfection. In fact, all of them have confessed to ignorance of many things. Thus Aristotle, speaking of the quadrature of a circle, and of the reasons for the order in heavenly bodies, himself states that he can only give probable arguments, and he leaves to others to decide what is certain in these things and their movers. Now happiness is a common good, to which many can arrive, unless they be prevented, as Aristotle says. It is true also of any natural end of a species, that it is obtained by the majority of the members of that species. Therefore man's ultimate happiness cannot consist in the aforesaid union. It is clear that Aristotle, whose opinion the philosophers in question endeavor to follow, did not hold that man's ultimate happiness consists in a union of this kind, for he proves that man's happiness is an operation of his own according to perfect virtue, wherefore he had to treat specially of the virtues, which he divided into moral and intellectual, and he proves that man's ultimate happiness consists in contemplation. Hence it follows that it is not seated in the act of a moral virtue, nor of prudence or art, and yet these are intellectual virtues. Consequently it must be an operation according to wisdom, which is the chief of the three remaining intellectual virtues, namely wisdom, knowledge and understanding, as he proves in 6 Ethic, 7. For which reason he declares that the wise man is a happy man. Now according to him wisdom is one of the speculative sciences, and the head of the others, and at the beginning of the metaphysics, he gives the name of wisdom to the science of which he purposes to treat. Clearly therefore the opinion of Aristotle was that the ultimate happiness which man is able to obtain in this life, is that knowledge of divine things which can be acquired through the speculative sciences. But this last way of knowing divine things, not through speculative sciences, but by a kind of natural process of generation, was invented by some of his commentators. Chapter 45. That it is impossible in this life to understand separate substances. Since then in this life separate substances cannot be known by us in the ways mentioned above, It remains for us to inquire whether we be able to understand separate substances in this life in any way at all. Themistius seeks to prove that this is possible by an argument a fortiori, for separate substances are more intelligible than material things, since the latter are intelligible insofar as the active intellect causes them to be actually understood, whereas the former are intelligible in themselves. If, therefore, our intellect understands these material things, much more is it adapted to understand separate substances. This argument must be appraised in the light of the various opinions about the possible intellect. For if the possible intellect is a power independent of matter, and has its being apart from the body, as Averroes maintains, it will follow that it has no necessary relation to things material, so that the more a thing is intelligible in itself, the more will it be intelligible to the possible intellect. But then it would seem to follow, since we understand from the beginning by means of the possible intellect, that we understand separate substances from the beginning, which is clearly false. Averroes seeks to avoid this difficulty, as we have explained above in setting forth his opinion, which we prove to be false. If, however, the possible intellect is not separate from the body in its very being, from the very fact that it is united in being to such a body, it has a necessary relation to material things, so that only through them can it acquire knowledge of other things. Hence it does not follow, if separate substances be more intelligible in themselves, that they be more intelligible to our intellect. This is proved by the words of Aristotle, for he says there that the difficulty of understanding those things is in us and not in them, because our intellect stands in relation to things most evident, as the eye of the owl to the sunlight. Consequently, seeing that we cannot arrive at understanding separate substances through understanding material things, as we have proved, it follows that our possible intellect can nowise understand separate substances. This appears again from the relation of the possible to the active intellect, because a passive power is in potentiality to those things only which are included in the range of its proper active principle, for every passive power has a corresponding active power in nature, otherwise passive power would be useless, since it cannot be brought to actuality except by an active principle. Hence we find that the sight is not receptive of other than colors which are enlightened by the light. Now the possible intellect is a power in a certain sense passive, and therefore it has its corresponding agent, namely the active intellect, which stands in relation to the possible intellect as light to the sight. Consequently, the possible intellect is in potentiality to those intelligible objects only which have been made so by the active intellect. Wherefore Aristotle, in describing each intellect, says that the possible intellect is the power to become all things, while the active intellect is the medium of making all things, so that the power in either case refers to the same objects, being active in the one and passive in the other. Since then separate substances are not made actually intelligible by the active intellect, and only material things are so made, it follows that the possible intellect extends to these alone, and therefore we cannot understand separate substances thereby. Wherefore Aristotle employed a fitting example, for the owl's eye can never see the light of the sun. And yet Averroes tries to depreciate this example, saying that the likeness between our intellect in relation to separate substances, and the owl's eye in relation to the sun's light, is one of difficulty, not of impossibility, and he proves this as follows. Because if it were impossible for us to understand things intelligible in themselves, separate substances to wit, they would be intelligible without purpose, as to no purpose would a thing be visible, if it could not be seen by any sight. Now this argument is clearly of no account at all, for even though these substances be never understood by us, they are understood by themselves, so that not without purpose would they be intelligible, as neither is the sun uselessly visible, to continue Aristotle's comparison, because the owl cannot see it, since man and other animals can see it. Accordingly, if we suppose the possible intellect to be united in being to the body, it cannot understand separate substances. It makes a difference, however, what we hold with regard to its substance. For if we suppose it to be a material force subject to generation and corruption, as some have maintained, it would follow that by its very substance it is confined to the understanding of material things, and consequently it would nowise be able to understand separate substances, since it could not possibly itself be separate. On the other hand, if the possible intellect, although united to the body, be incorruptible and independent of matter in its being, as we have proved above, 162, it follows that its being confined to the understanding of material things is incidental to it through its union with the body. And so, when the soul shall be separated from the body, the possible intellect will be able to understand things that are intelligible in themselves, namely separate substances, by the light of the active intellect, which in the soul is like the intellectual light that is in separate substances. This is what our faith holds about our understanding separate substances after death and not in this life. Chapter 46. That in this life the soul does not understand itself by itself. A certain difficulty would seem to arise against what we have been saying, on account of a passage of Augustine which must be carefully discussed. For he says 9 de Trin 8 tot de 3. Just as the mind gathers knowledge of corporeal things by means of the senses, so does it acquire knowledge of incorporeal things by itself. Therefore it also knows itself by itself, since itself is incorporeal. For it would seem to follow from these words that the soul understands itself by itself, and that by understanding itself, understands separate substances, and this is contrary to what we have proved. We must, accordingly, inquire how the soul understands itself by itself. Now it cannot possibly be said that by itself it understands what itself is, because a cognitive power is made actually cognizant by something in it whereby it knows. And if this be in it potentially, it knows potentially; if it be in it knows actually; and if it be in a middle way, it knows habitually. Now the soul is always actually present to itself, and never only potentially or habitually. Wherefore, if the soul knows itself by itself, it will always understand actually what itself is, and this is clearly false. Again, if the soul, by itself, understands what itself is, and since every man has a soul, every man will know what his soul is, which is evidently untrue. Moreover, knowledge that results from something implanted in us by nature is itself natural. For instance, the self-evident principles which are known through the light of the active intellect. Accordingly, if by the soul itself we know what the soul is, we shall know it naturally. But no one can err in things that we know naturally, for no one errs in self-evident principles, so that no one would err about what the soul is, if the soul knew this by itself. But this is clearly false, since many have maintained the soul to be this or that body, some, that it consisted in number or harmony. The soul does not, by itself, know what itself is. Besides, in every order that which is per se precedes and causes that which is accidental. Accordingly, that which is known per se, is known before all things that are known through something else, and is the principle through which they are known. For instance, first principles in comparison with conclusions. Therefore, if the soul, by itself, knows what itself is, this will be known per se, and consequently it will be known first, and will be the principle whereby other things are known. But this is clearly false, for science does not postulate what the soul is as being something already known, but proposes it as a point of inquiry from other sources. Therefore the soul does not by itself know what itself is. But it is clear that neither did Augustine intend this, for he says that when the soul seeks self-knowledge, it does not seek to see itself as though it were absent, but to discern itself as present, not to know itself as though it knew not, but in order to distinguish itself from what it knows to be distinct. Whereby he gives one to understand that by itself the soul knows itself as present to itself, but not as distinct from other things. Hence he says that some err in not distinguishing the soul from things that are different from it. Now through knowing what a thing is, one knows it as distinct from others. Wherefore a definition which states what a thing is, distinguishes the thing defined from all others. Consequently, Augustine did not mean that the soul by itself knows what itself is. Neither did Aristotle mean this. He says, in fact, that the possible intellect understands itself even as it understands other things, because it understands itself by means of an intelligible species, by which it is brought to actual intelligibility. For, considered in itself, it is only potentially an intelligible being. Now nothing is known according as it is in potentiality, but only according as it is in act. Wherefore separate substances, the substance whereof is as something actual in the genus of things intelligible, understand by their very substance what they are, whereas our possible intellect understands what it is, through the intelligible species by which it is made actually understanding. And so Aristotle shows the nature of the possible intellect from the act of understanding, namely that it is unmixed with the body and incorruptible, as we explained above. Accordingly, Augustine means to say that our mind knows itself by itself, inasmuch as it knows that it is, because by the very fact that it perceives itself to act, it perceives that it exists. And since it acts by itself, it knows by itself that it exists. In this way then the soul, by knowing itself, knows of the separate substances that they are, but not what they are, which is to understand their substance. For when either by demonstration or by faith we know about separate substances that they are certain intellectual substances, in neither way could we receive this knowledge, unless our soul derived from itself the knowledge of intellectual being. Consequently, we must use the science about the soul's intelligence as a principle on which to establish all our knowledge about separate substances. But it does not follow, if by the speculative sciences we are able to arrive at the knowledge of what the soul is, that we are able to arrive at the knowledge of what separate substances are, by means of these sciences, because our intelligence, by which we arrive at the knowledge of what the soul is far removed from the intelligence of a separate substance. Nevertheless, through knowing what our soul is, we are able to go so far as to know a remote genus of the separate substances, but this is not the same as to understand their substance. And just as through the soul itself we know that the soul is, inasmuch as we perceive its acts, and seek by a study of its acts and their objects to know what it is, through the principles of speculative sciences so too, concerning those things that are in our soul, namely its powers and habits, we know indeed that they are, inasmuch as we perceive their acts, but what they are we gather from the nature of these same acts. Chapter 47. That in this life we are unable to see God in His essence. If, in this life, we are unable to understand separate substances by reason of our intellect's innate relation to phantasms, much less can we see the divine essence in this life, since it is far above all separate substances. We may take it as a sign of this, that the more our mind is raised to the contemplation of spiritual things, the more is it withdrawn from sensible things. Now the divine substance is the highest term to which contemplation can reach. Hence the mind that sees the divine substance must be wholly freed from the senses, either by death or by rapture. Wherefore it is said in God's person, "Man shall not see me, and live." If it is stated in Holy Writ that some have seen God, we must understand this to have been either through an imaginary vision or even a bodily vision, the presence of the divine power being shown by corporeal species, whether appearing externally, or formed internally in the imagination, or by gathering some intellectual knowledge of God from His spiritual effects. A difficulty, however, arises through some words of Augustine which would seem to imply that we are able to understand God in this life, for he says that with the eyes of the soul we see the form of our being and of our actions, whether affected in ourselves or truly and rightly on other bodies, in the eternal truth, from which all temporal things proceed. Again he says, "If we both see that what you say is true, and that what I say is true," where, I ask, do we see this? Surely, neither I in thee, nor thou in me, but both of us in the immutable truth itself which transcends our minds. And he says that we judge of all things according to the divine truth. And again, we must first know the truth by which other things can be known, referring, it would seem, to the divine truth. It would seem then, from his words, that we see God Himself, who is His own truth, and that through Him we know other things. Other words of His would seem to point to the same conclusion, in 12 Doctrine 8:2, where He says it is the duty of reason to judge of these corporeal things, according to the incorporeal and eternal ideas which, unless they were above the human mind, would surely not be unchangeable. Now unchangeable and eternal ideas cannot be elsewhere than in God, since according to the teaching of faith, God alone is eternal. Accordingly, it would seem to follow that we can see God in this life, and that through seeing Him and the ideas of things in Him, we judge of other things. Yet it is not to be believed that Augustine, by these words, meant that we are able in this life to see God in His essence. We must therefore inquire how, in this life, we see that unchangeable truth, or these eternal ideas, and how judge of them according to it. Augustine allows that truth is in the soul (2 Sol. 19), wherefore he proves the immortality of the soul from the eternity of truth. Now truth is in the soul not only in the same way as God is said to be in all things by His essence, or as He is in all things by His likeness, a thing being true so far as it is like to God, for then the soul would not be higher than other things in this respect. It is therefore in the soul in a special way, forasmuch as the soul knows the truth. Accordingly, just as the soul and other things are said to be true in their nature, according as they are likened to that supreme nature, which is truth itself, since it is its own being understood by itself, so too, that which is known by the soul, is true so far as it bears a likeness to that divine truth which God knows. Wherefore a gloss on Psalms 11:2, truths are decayed from among the children of men, says that as a mirror gives many reflections of one face, so are many truths reflected in men's minds from the first truth. Now although different things are known, and different things believed to be true, by different people, yet some truths there are in which all men agree, such as first principles both of the speculative and of the practical intellect, inasmuch as a kind of image of the divine truth is reflected in the minds of all men. Consequently, when a mind knows with certitude anything at all, and by tracing it back to the principles by which we judge of everything, comes to see it in those principles, it is said to see all such things in the divine truth or in the eternal ideas, and to judge of all things according to them. This explanation is confirmed by Augustine's words: the speculations of science are seen in the divine truth, even as these visible things are seen in the light of the sun, for it is evident that these things are not seen in the body of the sun, but by the light, which is a likeness of the solar brilliance reflected in the air, and cast upon such bodies. Therefore, from these words of Augustine, we cannot conclude that God is seen in His essence in this life, but only as in a mirror, and to this the Apostle witnesses: as regards the knowledge of this life, we see now through a glass in a dark manner. And though this mirror, which is the human mind, reflects the likeness of God more faithfully than creatures of lower degree, yet the knowledge of God that can be gathered from the human mind does not surpass the knowledge gathered from sensible things, since even the soul knows what itself is through understanding the nature of sensible things, as already stated. Consequently, even in this way God is not known in higher fashion than the cause is known from its effect. Chapter 48. That man's ultimate happiness is not in this life. Seeing then that man's ultimate happiness does not consist in that knowledge of God whereby he is known by all or many in a vague kind of opinion, nor again in that knowledge of God whereby he is known in science through demonstration, nor in that knowledge whereby he is known through faith, as we have proved above, and seeing that it is not possible in this life to arrive at a higher knowledge of God in His essence, or at least so that we understand other separate substances, and thus know God through that which is nearest to Him, so to say, as we have proved, and since we must place our ultimate happiness in some kind of knowledge of God, as we have shown, it is impossible for man's happiness to be in this life. Again, man's last end is the term of his natural appetite, so that when he has obtained it, he desires nothing more, because if he still has a movement towards something, He has not yet reached an end wherein to be at rest. Now, this cannot happen in this life, since the more man understands, the more is the desire to understand increased in him, this being natural to man, unless perhaps someone there be who understands all things, and in this life this never did nor can happen to anyone that was a mere man, seeing that in this life we are unable to know separate substances which in themselves are most intelligible, as we have proved. Therefore man's ultimate happiness cannot possibly be in this life. Besides, whatever is in motion towards an end, has a natural desire to be established and at rest therein. Hence a body does not move away from the place towards which it has a natural movement, except by a violent movement which is contrary to that appetite. Now happiness is the last end which man desires naturally. Therefore it is his natural desire to be established in happiness. Consequently, unless together with happiness he acquires a state of immobility, he is not yet happy, since his natural desire is not yet at rest. When therefore a man acquires happiness, he also acquires stability and rest, so that all agree in conceiving stability as a necessary condition of happiness. Hence the philosopher says we do not look upon the happy man as a kind of chameleon. Now, in this life there is no sure stability, since, however happy a man may be, sickness and misfortune may come upon him, so that he is hindered in the operation, whatever it be, in which his happiness consists. Therefore man's ultimate happiness cannot be in this life. Moreover, it would seem unfitting and unreasonable for a thing to take a long time in becoming, and to have but a short time in being, for it would follow that for a longer duration of time nature would be deprived of its end. Hence we see that animals which live but a short time, are perfected in a short time, but, if happiness consists in a perfect operation according to perfect virtue, whether intellectual or moral, it cannot possibly come to man except after a long time. This is most evident in speculative matters, wherein man's ultimate happiness consists, as we have proved, for hardly is man able to arrive at perfection in the speculations of science, even though he reach the last stage of life, and then in the majority of cases, but a short space of life remains to him. Therefore man's ultimate happiness cannot be in this life. Further, all admit that happiness is a perfect good, else it would not bring rest to the appetite. Now perfect good is that which is wholly free from any admixture of evil, just as that which is perfectly white is that which is entirely free from any admixture of black. But man cannot be wholly free from evils in this state of life, not only from evils of the body, such as hunger, thirst, heat, cold and the like, but also from evils of the soul. For no one is there who at times is not disturbed by inordinate passions, who sometimes does not go beyond the mean, wherein virtue consists, either in excess or in deficiency, who is not deceived in something or another, or at least ignores what he would wish to know, or feels doubtful about an opinion of which he would like to be certain. Therefore no man is happy in this life. Again, man naturally shuns death, and is sad about it, not only shunning it now when he feels its presence, but also when he thinks about it. But man, in this life, cannot obtain not to die. Therefore it is not possible for man to be happy in this life. Besides, ultimate happiness consists not in a habit but in an operation, since habits are for the sake of actions. But in this life it is impossible to perform any action continuously. Therefore man cannot be entirely happy in this life. Further, the more a thing is desired and loved, the more does its loss bring sorrow and pain. Now happiness is most desired and loved. Therefore its loss brings the greatest sorrow. But if there be ultimate happiness in this life, it will certainly be lost, at least by death. Nor is it certain that it will last till death, since it is possible for every man in this life to encounter sickness, whereby he is wholly hindered from the operation of virtue, such as madness and the like, which hinder the use of reason. Such happiness therefore always has sorrow naturally connected with it, and consequently it will not be perfect happiness. But someone might say that, since happiness is a good of the intellectual nature, perfect and true happiness is for those in whom the intellectual nature is perfect, namely in separate substances, and that it is imperfect in man, by way of a kind of participation, because he can arrive at a full understanding of the truth only by a sort of movement of inquiry, and fails entirely to understand things that are by nature most intelligible, as we have proved. Wherefore neither is happiness, in its perfect form, possible to man, yet he has a certain participation thereof, even in this life. This seems to have been Aristotle's opinion about happiness. Wherefore 1 Ethic. 10. Inquiring whether misfortunes destroy happiness, he shows that happiness seems especially to consist in deeds of virtue, which seem to be most stable in this life, and concludes that those who in this life attain to this perfection are happy as men, as though not attaining to happiness simply, but in a human way. We must now show that this explanation does not avoid the foregoing arguments, for although man is below the separate substances in the natural order, he is above irrational creatures, wherefore he attains his ultimate end in a more perfect way than they. Now these attain their last end so perfectly that they seek nothing further. Thus a heavy body rests when it is in its own proper place, and when an animal enjoys sensible pleasure, its natural desire is at rest. Much more therefore when man has obtained his last end, must his natural desire be at rest. But this cannot happen in this life. Therefore in this life man does not obtain happiness considered as his proper end, as we have proved. Therefore he must obtain it after this life. Again, the natural desire cannot be void, since nature does nothing in vain. But nature's desire would be void if it could never be fulfilled. Therefore man's natural desire can be fulfilled, but not in this life, as we have shown. Therefore it must be fulfilled after this life. Therefore man's ultimate happiness is after this life. Besides, as long as a thing is in motion towards perfection, it has not reached its last end. Now in the knowledge of truth all men are ever in motion and tending towards perfection, because those who follow make discoveries in addition to those made by their predecessors, as stated in 2 Metaphysics. Therefore in the knowledge of truth man is not situated as though he had arrived at his last end. Since then, as Aristotle himself shows, man's ultimate happiness in this life consists apparently in speculation, whereby he seeks the knowledge of truth, we cannot possibly allow that man obtains his last end in this life. Moreover, whatever is in potentiality tends to become actual, so that as long as it is not wholly actual, it has not reached its last end. Now our intellect is in potentiality to the knowledge of the forms of all things, and it becomes actual when it knows any one of them. Consequently it will not be wholly actual, nor in possession of its last end, except when it knows all, at least these material things. But man cannot obtain this through speculative sciences, by which in this life we know truth. Therefore man's ultimate happiness cannot be in this life. For these and like reasons Alexander and Averroes held that man's ultimate happiness does not consist in human knowledge obtained through speculative sciences, but in that which results from conjunction with a separate substance, which conjunction they deemed possible to man in this life. But as Aristotle realized that man has no knowledge in this life other than that which he obtains through speculative sciences, he maintained that man attains to happiness, not perfect, but proportionate to his capacity. Hence it becomes sufficiently clear how these great minds suffered from being so straitened on every side. We, however, will avoid these straits if we suppose, in accordance with the foregoing arguments, that man is able to reach perfect happiness after this life, since man has an immortal soul, and that in that state his soul will understand in the same way as separate substances understand, as we proved in the second book. Therefore man's ultimate happiness will consist in that knowledge of God which he possesses after this life, a knowledge similar to that by which separate substances know him. Hence our Lord promises us a reward in heaven, and states that the saints shall be as the angels who always see God in heaven. Matthew 18, 10. Chapter 49. That separate substances do not see God in his essence through knowing him by their own essences. We must now inquire whether this same knowledge whereby after death separate substances and souls know God by their own essences, be sufficient for their ultimate happiness. In order to discover the truth in this matter, we must first of all show that to know God in this way is not to know His essence. An effect may be known through its cause in several ways. First, when the effect is taken as the means of knowing the existence and qualities of the cause, this happens in sciences which prove the cause from the effect. Secondly, when the cause is seen in the effect itself, inasmuch as the likeness of the cause is reflected in the effect, thus a man is seen in a mirror on account of his likeness. This way differs from the first, because in the first there are two knowledges, of effect and of cause, whereof one is the cause of the other, for the knowledge of the effect is the cause of our knowing its cause. Whereas in the second way there is one sight of both, because while seeing the effect we see the cause therein at the same time. Thirdly, when the very likeness of the cause in the effect is the form by which the cause is known by its effect. For instance, if a box had an intellect, and were to know by its own form the art from which that very form had been produced in likeness to that art. But by none of these ways is it possible to know from its effect what the cause is, unless the effect equate the cause, and express the whole power of the cause. Now separate substances know God by their substances in the same way as a cause is known from its effect, not however in the first way, because then their knowledge would be discursive, but in the second way, inasmuch as one of them sees God in another, and in the third way, inasmuch as each of them sees God in itself. Yet none of them is an effect equaling God's power, as we have shown in the second book. Therefore they cannot see the divine essence by this kind of knowledge. Besides, the intelligible likeness whereby a thing is understood as to its substance must be of the same species. In fact, it must be its species, even as the form of the house, which is in the architect's mind, is of the same species as the form of the house which exists in matter, or rather it is its species, for we do not understand what an ass is, or what a horse is, through the species of a man. But the nature of a separate substance is not of the same species as the divine nature, indeed not even of the same genus, as we showed in the first book. Therefore a separate substance cannot possibly understand God through its own nature. Further, every created thing is confined to a certain genus or species, but the divine essence is infinite, comprising within itself the entire perfection of all being, as we proved in the first book. The divine substance cannot be seen through anything created. Moreover, every intelligible species through which the quiddity or essence of a thing is understood, comprehends that thing in representing it, wherefore words signifying what a thing is are called terms and definitions. But no created image can possibly represent God thus, since every created image belongs to some fixed genus, whereas God does not, as was proved in the first book. Therefore it is not possible to understand the divine substance through a created image. Further, it was proved in the first book that God's substance is His being. But the being of a separate substance is distinct from its substance, as we proved in the second book. Therefore the essence of a separate substance is not a sufficient medium whereby God may be seen in His essence. And yet the separate substance, through its own substance, knows about God, that He is the cause of all things, that He is above all and far removed from all, not only from the things that are, but even from those that can be conceived by the created mind. This knowledge about God we also are able somewhat to obtain, because from His effects we know of God that He is, and that He is the cause of other things, surpassing all and remote from all. And this is the limit and the highest point of our knowledge in this life, where, as Dionysius says, we are united to God as to something unknown. This happens when we know of Him what He is not, while what He is remains utterly unknown. Hence, in order to indicate the ignorance of this most sublime knowledge, it was said to Moses that he went to the dark cloud wherein God was. Since, however, the lower nature in its summit attains only to what is lowest in the higher nature, it follows that this same knowledge is more sublime in separate substances than in us. This can be shown as to each way of attaining to this knowledge. For if the cause be known by its effect, the nearer that effect is, and the clearer its resemblance to its cause, the more evident does it make the existence of that cause. Now separate substances, that know God by themselves, are nearer effects and bear clearer resemblance to God than the effects through which we know God. Therefore, separate substances know more certainly and more clearly than we that God exists. Again, since by negations we come by any way whatever to a proper knowledge of a thing, as stated above, the more things one knows to be removed from God, and the greater their propinquity, the nearer does one approach to a proper knowledge of Him. Even so, he who knows that man is neither inanimate nor insensible, approaches nearer to a proper knowledge of man than one who knows only that he is not inanimate, although neither of them knows what man is. Now, separate substances know more than we, and the things that are nearer to God, and consequently by their intelligence remove from God more things and nearer things from God than we do. Therefore they approach nearer to a proper knowledge of God than we, although neither do they, through understanding themselves, see the divine substance. Again, the higher the persons over whom one knows a man to be placed, the better the knowledge one has of his eminence. Thus, although a peasant may know that the king is the highest in the land, yet since he knows only some of the lowest officials of the kingdom, with whom he has business, he does not realize the king's exalted position, as one who knows the dignity of all the great men of the kingdom, over whom he knows the king to be placed, although neither of them comprehends the height of the kingly rank. Now we know none but the lowest things, and consequently, although we know that God is far above all, we do not know the divine supereminence as the separate substances do, to whom the highest orders of things are known, while they know God to be higher than them all. Again, it is clear that the casualty and virtue of a cause are all the better known, according as more and greater effects thereof are known. Wherefore it evidently follows that separate substances know the divine casualty and power better than we, although we know Him to be the cause of all. Chapter 50. That the natural desire of the separate substances is not set at rest in the natural knowledge they have of God. Now it is not possible that the separate substances' natural desire rest in such a knowledge of God, for whatever is imperfect in a species, seeks to acquire the perfection of that species. Thus whoso has an opinion about a matter, and therefore imperfect knowledge about it, for this very reason is spurred to the desire for certain knowledge about it. Now the aforesaid knowledge which separate substances have about God without knowing His substance, is an imperfect kind of knowledge, for we do not deem ourselves to know a thing if we know not its substance, so that the chief point in knowing a thing is to know what it is. Therefore this knowledge which the separate substances have about God does not set their appetite at rest, but spurs it on to the vision of the divine substance. Again, the knowledge of effects is an incitement to know the cause wherefore men began to philosophize, because they sought the causes of things. Therefore the desire for knowledge naturally implanted in all intellectual substances does not rest unless, knowing the substance of effects, they know also the substance of their cause. Consequently, since separate substances know that God is the cause of all the things whose substances they see, their natural desire does not rest, unless they see God's substance also. Besides, as there is a connection between knowing the adequate cause propter quid of a thing being so and so, and knowing that it is so, so is there a connection between knowing about a thing what it is quid est, and knowing that it exists an est. Because if we know the adequate cause of a thing being so and so, we can prove that it is so, for example, that the moon undergoes eclipse. Even so, if we know of a thing what it is, we can prove that it exists. Such is the teaching in two poster. I. Now we observe that those who know that a thing is so and so, naturally seek to know the adequate cause of its being so. Therefore those who know that a thing exists, naturally seek to know what it is, and this is to know its essence. Therefore the natural desire for knowledge is not set at rest by the knowledge of God whereby it is known that He exists. Further, nothing finite can set the intellect's desire at rest. This is proved from the fact that the intellect, given any finite object, strives to go beyond it, so that given a finite line of any length, it strives to apprehend a longer, and it is the same in numbers, and this is the reason why we can add indefinitely to numbers and mathematical lines. Now the excellence and power of any created substance is finite, therefore the intellect of a separate substance is not satisfied with knowing separate substances, however excellent they be, but still tends by its natural desire to understand the substance which is of infinite excellence, as we proved in the first book, concerning the divine substance. Moreover, just as there is a natural desire for knowledge in all intellectual natures, so is there in them a natural desire to rid themselves of ignorance or nascence. Now separate substances, as stated, know in the manner already mentioned, that God's substance is above them, and above everything that they understand, wherefore they know that the divine substance is unknown to them. Therefore their natural desire tends to understand the divine substance. Besides, the nearer a thing is to its end, the greater the desire with which it tends to that end, wherefore we may notice that the natural movement of bodies is increased towards the end. Now the intellect of separate substances is nearer to the knowledge of God than ours, and consequently they desire to know God more intensely than we do, and however much we know that God is, and other things mentioned above, we still go on desiring and seek to know him in his essence. Much more therefore do separate substances desire this naturally, and consequently their natural desire is not satisfied with the above mentioned knowledge of God. Hence we conclude that the ultimate happiness of a separate substance does not consist in the knowledge whereby it knows God by its own substance, since its desire still leads it on to the substance of God. It also clearly follows from this that ultimate happiness is to be sought nowhere else but in an operation of the intellect, since no desire leads us so high as the desire of knowing the truth. For all our desires, whether of pleasure or of anything else that man wants, can be satisfied with other things, whereas the aforesaid desire rests not until it has reached God, the supreme cause and maker of all. Hence wisdom rightly says, "I dwell in the highest places, and my throne is in a pillar of a cloud," and it is said that wisdom by her maids inviteth to the tower. They should blush, then, who seek man's happiness in the lowest things, whereas it is placed on such a height.